Welcome to the Umpiring Fast Pitch Softball Podcast. I'm David.
And I'm Pete. And today we're going to talk about some of the rule differences between NFHS and NCAA softball. During this part of the season, both of those are going on, and some umpires work both sanctions throughout the week. And so we want to make sure that everyone kind of has some of these differences in mind. So when they work the sanctions, that they're applying the right rules, right, David?
Yeah, that's right. And actually, it's kind of a self-fulfilling thing because I wanted to
you got
to
do it.
Yeah, I have a high school game in a couple of weeks and a college game the very next Saturday. So really wanting to do it for me. So what are we going to start with, Pete?
Yeah, so first thing that comes up is bunting. For the NFHS, a bunt is a legally batted ball not swung at, but intentionally tapped with the bat. An attempted bunt is any non-swinging movement of the bat intended to tap the ball into play. Holding the bat in the strike zone is considered a bunt attempt. In order to take a pitch, the bat must be pulled back and away from the ball, which is in 281 and 282 of our rule book.
And that is exactly the same in NCAA. In order to take a pitch, the bat must be withdrawn, pulled backward from away from the ball.
Yep, great. For the official lineup, the lineup is, of course, the official document listing the starting players and substitutes of a given team. For NFHS, you have to have the first initial and last name. You also want to list their position and numbers. And then after the lineup card has been submitted and verified by the umpire, if any change is subsequently made to a player or a substitute name or number, or if a player or substitute is added to the lineup card, the umpire will issue a team warning to the head coach of the team involved. Any further changes made to a player or substitute name or number results in the head coach being restricted to the dugout or bench for the remainder of the game. That's 3-1-3.
And for the NCAA, you need to have the starting players and substitutes listed given for the team. It has to have their first and last name, their defensive position, and uniform number of each player. We also have to have the first and last name of the head coach. In the event that the team has two coaches or co-head coaches, one shall be designated as the head coach for that game. This is really important because only the head coach can come out of the dugout to argue calls, right?
Yep.
If somebody other than the head coach comes out, it's an immediate ejection. So we got to be really, really careful.
And then what we're pointing out there too is that in NCAA, you have to give the first name. So like if it was me on the lineup in NFHS, I'd be P. Shearer. But in NCAA, I need to be Pete Shearer. You need to have the names listed like that.
Yep, that's right.
Next is for the strike zone. For the strike zone in high school, it's between the batter's armpits and the top of the knees. We kind of dove into this pretty well a couple episodes back, but for high school, armpits to knees, basically.
Yeah, and for the NCAA, it's the batter's sternum, the bottom of the batter's sternum to the top of her knees. Now, this very clearly says, Rule 11-3-1 says the top of the ball must be in the horizontal plane and either side of the ball in the vertical plane of the strike zone. Like Pete said, we covered this extensively. I can tell you that if the very tip top of the ball is at the top of the knee and the rest of the ball is below the knee, you're going to catch a lot of flack on that one. So just be careful and make sure that you're consistent in what you're calling. The rule book says the top of the ball must be in the horizontal plane and either side of the ball in the vertical plane. And this is from the bottom of the batter's sternum and the top of her knees.
Yep. For double base in NFHS, it's by state association adoption, but a double first base is permitted. In Ohio, it is. The base shall be one or a two-piece unit, 15 by 30 inches. The base in foul territory should be a color other than white. Bases are equal in height, 5 inches max, which is 1-2-1.
Yeah. A little further, OHSAA actually is it's a required
base.
Yep.
Yeah.
NCAA, however, it is allowed, and both teams have to agree that you're going to be using it, mm-hmm. and they have to know about it ahead of time.
So that's even like prior to the match. If one of the teams is, even if Alabama uses a double first base every single game, if Florida shows up and they're like, "Nah, there's no base,"
that's right. Yeah, they have to agree. Yep.
Nice. Next, we're going to talk about erasing batter's box lines in Federation in high school. It's a strike on the batter if the offense were to intentionally remove the line, or a ball if the defense were to do it. After an occurrence, a team warning is issued, and the next violation is a ball or a strike, and the offender or coach is restricted to the dugout. That's 6-3-17.
And in NCAA, it's a strike on the batter if the offense intentionally removes the lines, and a ball if the defense does the same. So that's the same. In addition, a warning shall be issued to the offending team. Subsequent violation by the same team shall result in an ejection of the offender. And that's 220.3 effect and 11.3.2.6 effect.
Yeah, and I don't know if I mentioned this, but yeah, it's absolutely right. It's intentionally removing the line that becomes important because, you know, people walk into the dugout, they into the batter's box, they kind of drag their feet. They get rid of some of the line. Were they dragging their feet because they were being sneaky, or did they just not pick up their feet when they're walking.
Right.
You know, so yeah, they need to intentionally be doing that.
And who does this? Slappers. Slappers do this, right?
Yeah. Yeah, because that's the number one thing you want to do. The line they most care about is the one closest to the pitcher, because you want, that's the one you're most likely to be out of the box on. So that's what you're looking for. Next, we're going to talk a little bit about bats. We're not going to go into the details of everything that would make a bat legal. But the big difference here is that in NFHS, at the plate meeting, you're going to ask the coach, you're going to ask each coach if their team is legally and properly equipped. And then if they were to violate, they're in trouble because, you know, they've broken that, their oath. They said it, and there's no further checking. But in college, it's a little different, right?
Yeah, in college, there's going to be two different tests. They're going to have compression tests before the game, administered by the home school usually. And then as the umpires are approaching the field and getting ready for the game, they're going to do a physical inspection of the bats looking for damage and a sticker that proves that it was compression
examined
tested.
That, yep. Yeah. And they do that before every game. It has to be compression tested. You have to do that. Well, in a doubleheader, is it done once before the entire doubleheader?
The compression test is done once. Yep. And sometimes even for tournaments, they're done once for a tournament. It could be a multi-day tournament and they're done once, but they're inspected, physically inspected by the umpires for that game before every game.
Okay. Next, we're going to talk about warm-up bats. So in high school, warm-up bats used in the on-deck circle shall have all parts permanently and securely attached at the time of manufacture and at the time of use. No more than two bats should be used when warming up on the on-deck circle. Devices added to a bat for warm-up purposes shall be commercially manufactured specifically for a softball bat and shall be securely attached so as not to disengage during use. Such devices shall take but not exceed the general shape and size of a bat, including the grip. So you notice some things here is a donut, the round donut you think about that, you know, looks literally bagel-shaped or everything else, doesn't count because it's not securely and permanently attached, and it does not take the shape and size. What about the kind of bat sleeve that you slide on that's like kind of the shape of a bat? Looks like a hot dog bun that would be closed or something. You know, slides on that way and makes the bat slightly heavier. Probably still not, right? Because it says permanently and securely attached at the time of manufacture and then also at the time of use.
That's right.
The point there is
not
that,
on, right?
Yeah, the point, because some people might want to argue and say, well, the point there is that the donut won't come off because I'm swinging the bat and the force is going to, you know, the size. No, that's not the point. The point that why they mentioned that it needs to be secure at the time of use is it could have been secure at the time of manufacture, but since become broken or altered or damaged or whatever, and it needs to just remain securely in place. So that's high school. What about you?
Yeah, it's actually similar, but more clear in the NCAA, which is one of the funny things. You know, a lot of times they're a little more verbose and you have to pick through it. But in this one, for warm-up bats, you can use non-altered one-piece wooden baseball or softball bats in the pregame warm-ups and on-deck circle, which is cool, in addition to legal softball bats, so a regular softball bat can be used. And then it very clearly states, attachments to a bat, such as sleeves, donuts, and fans, are not allowed in the on-deck circle.
Sleeves, that's the word I was looking for. I was thinking about a bat sleeve.
Oh, sleeves, yep. So the interesting part there is you could actually put a wooden baseball bat in there,
yeah,
the heavier, you know, for the for the players to swing.
It doesn't mention, in NFHS, it mentions, so if you wanted to swing something heavier to swing, you could swing two bats in high school. You know, no more than two, but you could swing two. Yours doesn't mention anything about that. Do you think there's a limit? Like, could you swing three or can you only swing one? So because, you know, a limit's not mentioned, is there no limit or is it?
I'm seeing a no limit, but I'll tell you what, I'd run from the player that's able to swing three.
Maybe pitch her away.
Yeah, maybe pitch her away. Or super, super tight, right? In on the hands.
Next, we're going to talk about reentry. So for Federation ball, any player may be substituted for or replaced and reentered once, provided that the player occupies the same position in the batting order, 3-3-5.
And for the NCAA, only the starters have that ability. So any substitutes that go in the game, once that substitute comes out, they do not have reentry.
And that's a big difference. So as you're going through, definitely keep that one in mind.
So Pete, there's not a real difference here, but I wanted to talk a little bit about projected substitutes and the difference. So again, not a rule difference really, but there's some verbiage difference. So in the NCAA, it says projected re-entries are not allowed, which is absolutely true. In NFHS, how do they say it?
So the phrasing here is a projected substitute is the act of entering a substitute without first removing a player from that position in the lineup. They are not permitted. So here they give you a little explanation and then go, wah, wah.
Yeah.
And so the big difference there is why is anyone talking about this thing that isn't allowed? Is because in USA softball in the summer, there's no rule about it and it's controlled by umpires as part of good game management. So it may actually be even encouraged during the summer, but anything you're doing here in the spring, high school or college, it's a no.
Yep. So projected reentries and future subs, there's a difference here too. If an offensive coach comes in and says, hey, I'm going to put 3 in for 5 and 6 in for 9.
Mm-hmm.
Well, isn't 6's time to bat yet. Can he make that substitution? He absolutely can.
Yeah.
That's not a projected sub. He actually subbed it. So you write it on your scorecard. Yeah. You know,
and if that person were to not bat, now they better go play the field.
That's right. Yeah, we got a problem, right?
Yeah.
Because she's in the game unless he or she comes back and changes that again. So there's a difference between projected reentry. So it's like, hey, after she bats, mm-hmm. you know, I'm going to run for her. You know, I'm going to put the flex in to run for her. Nope. You got to wait till she bats. If she gets on base, then you come make your substitution to let the flex run, right? And not to be confused with flex and DP rules, that could have been any substitute.
Right.
But you just don't let it happen ahead of time.
One kind of interesting difference here, too, is a disqualified player. Anyone who's prohibited from playing for whatever reason, that could be whatever reason you have disqualified them. In high school, that restricted player is not allowed to leave the bench or dugout for the remainder of the game. Probably because we're usually dealing with youths and they need some supervision, guidance, and chaperoning. So we make them stay in the bench area. They can't go hit the showers or do anything like that. But what do we got in college?
So in college, Pete, there's no rule.
So they could go, if you've been removed from the game, you've been ejected or disqualified in some way, you can go to the showers, you can go home. And, you know, if your school won't suspend you or kick you off the team,
right.
You have a lot more leeway in college.
Yeah, and I think you hit on it, right? They're adults in NCAA, they're adults. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And did you say the two Utes earlier?
I don't know, maybe.
If anybody gets that reference, hit us up on Facebook if you know what movie that's from. The two Utes.
Did you say Utes? What's a Ute? So this is, you know, you've already mentioned this a little bit when we talked about the coaches and identifying whom the head coach is on the lineup card and what happens if you're not the head coach. But just in general, arguing balls and strikes. So in high school, the offender will be ejected for arguing balls and strikes. However, unless it's judged to be minor, in which case the offender will be warned and then ejected if they do it again. So high school, you got a little leeway here that if you, it's a minor inconvenience. You just, maybe you did it and oops, I wasn't thinking. It's okay. We're going to take that easy. But in college, what do we got here?
Any arguing of the judgment of balls and strikes will result in a team warning. And any repeat offenses will result in an ejection of the team member that did it.
So in that case, not the first one will get you tossed. The second one will get you tossed, regardless of intent, either size or volume and, you know, I don't know what the word I'm even looking for. Intensity of the offense. Doesn't matter. You do it two times.
Second time, you're out.
Yeah.
And, for us, that's for anybody on the team, right? So
yeah.
Pete argued balls and strikes, got us a team warning. David came out to argue balls and strikes. David's out.
Yeah, that's the important part. It's a team warning. You guys are one team. You all get punished.
Funny thing here, since we're talking about, you know, arguing balls and strikes, I had heard this at a camp one time where the catcher turned around and said, you know, kind of showing the umpire up a little bit and said, well, where was that? And the umpire said, I have no idea. I was watching the strike zone and the ball never showed up. So I just thought that was kind of funny. I don't think we should probably say that. But
no, yeah, you don't. I feel like we should look a little more broadly than that.
Yeah, but I think it was funny. You know, it absolutely makes sense. I remember from the, sorry, sidebar, I have to, because this is rule stuff and this is really boring. So we got to do a little bit of a sidebar thing here.
Mix it up
here.
A little. All right.
I have used for years, and I don't use it as much in college ball, and I'd have to think about that, see if I even ever have said it. I'd have to be pretty frustrated with a college player. But anyway, catchers that will catch a ball and move it 6 inches, mm-hmm. and then you ball it, and then they say, where was that? I'm like, you moved the ball 6 inches after you caught it, catch. You know where it was. So if you were sticking it, and then you didn't get your call, I get it, but dude, you pushed it 6 inches.
Yeah.
So you know where it was, catch.
Yeah, you moved it right to left. You knew it was too far right. Cut it out.
Yeah, stop it.
So this one's got some differences here. So conferences. So in high school, you've got, for the offense, there'll be no more than one charge conference between team members and the batter, our team representatives and the batter, another team representative and or runners in an inning. No more than one charge conference in an inning. The umpire should not permit any such conferences in excess of one per inning. In defense, there should be only 3 charge conferences between the manager or other team representative from the dugout with any defensive players in a 7-inning game. Three conferences. For every inning beyond 7, there'll be 1 conference per inning between the manager or team representative. So offense, 1 per inning. Defense, 3 for the whole game. That's high school.
That's high school. In college, it's completely different. You have seven conferences for a team representative. So a manager, a coach, whatever, you have seven of those, whether they're offense or defense. And on the player-to-player conferences, they also have seven. So every time the catcher says, hey, blue time, you know, I want to go talk to my pitcher, that's one. She has six more. Mm-hmm. So you have seven of those. Defensive conferences, you can only have one per inning, though. The second one, you know, you need to inform the umpire that you're going to make a pitching change. And please, this came up a couple of years ago in the NCAA. Don't really try to do some preventative umpiring here. Don't let that head coach, you know, who's going to go make the pitching change, step across into fair territory without him telling you that he's making a pitching change. Because what they're trying to avoid there is, I'm going to go talk to her again and see if she's okay to proceed. And then she says no, so now I'm going to make a pitching change. It's like, nope, you're not allowed to do that. You can have one conference this inning, and then the second time you cross that foul line, you better have told me that you're making a pitching change, because if you don't, you just tried to use two conferences in the same inning for defense, and that is a no-go.
Yep.
So what about the run-ahead rule?
So in high school, the state association may adopt game-ending procedures that determine how games are ended, including suspended games. However, if the state association does not have established game-ending procedures, by mutual agreement of the opposing coaches or plate umpire, the remaining play may be shortened at any time or the game terminated. So Ohio has their rules. However, NCAA is not so loosey-goosey on letting people do what they want to do. So what do they do instead?
So in the NCAA, a regulation game shall be declared by the plate umpire if one team is ahead of after five or more complete innings, ahead by eight. It doesn't say this on the thing here. It's rule 6.14. Oh, eight run rule. I'm sorry. It says a regulation 8-run rule game shall be declared by the plate umpire if one team is ahead after five or more complete innings.
Yep.
That's a little bit misleading, too, because it's not five or more complete innings, right? If the home team is ahead by eight after four and the visiting team comes up in the top of five and mm-hmm. they don't score, we're not going to play the bottom.
Yeah, the complete inning five. So then we start really getting into, well, what's a possibly complete inning? I mean, an inning can, because the seventh inning, you know, you don't make the home team bat if they're ahead.
Right.
And the seventh inning is also complete. So it's like the final, I guess a complete inning, if it's the final inning, may only be half an inning.
Yeah.
So we're.
Anyway, just make sure that you know it's eight after five.
Yeah.
In the NCAA. And your state association will tell you what your game ending run ahead rules are by state.
So kind of a, I know there's a difference here. So for pitching. This is kind of under the subheading here is preliminaries. So this is, you know, prior to starting the pitch. So for high school, before starting the pitch, the pitcher shall comply with the following, having both feet on the ground and in contact or behind the pitcher's plate, which is 611, 612A and B. So go dig in. You should know your rule six if you're umpiring for sure.
Rule six, what one's that?
Pitching.
Oh, that's the pitching rule. Got it. So in the NCAA, the pitcher is considered to be in the pitching position when she has her hands apart, her pivot foot in contact with the pitcher's plate, both feet on the ground, the pivot foot within a 24-inch length of the pitcher's plate, the hips in line with first and third bases. The stride foot can be on pitcher's line, pitcher's plate, rather than within the 24-inch length of the pitcher's plate. The stride foot may be on or behind the pitcher's plate, as far back as desired. Once the pitcher initially sets the toe of her stride foot, she may not move that foot in any direction prior to the step, stride, and delivery. So that's 10-1-1 and 10-2-1-2. This one's interesting to me, and I think I'm going to jump into the book and do another take on it. I'm going to read the whole rule here on 10-1 and 10-2, because one of the things I have, you're not allowed to step back. Mm-hmm. Is how I have it in my brain.
Yeah.
And I actually had a game.
But you can start back.
Yeah, you can start back.
This is explaining.
Yeah, that's right. But I had a game where this particular player would be in violation of the rule as it's written here on this PDF, you know, not the actual rule book. So I'm going to grab the rule book real quick. But the picture of the game I'm talking about, she would set her toe there. Mm-hmm. And then as part of her nervousness, she would like tap her toe.
Yeah.
She wouldn't step back further. And so I didn't ding her. Right, because she wasn't moving it back from where she set it. She was picking it up and putting it down like you know, half an inch, you know, just yeah. like tapping her foot. By what this thing says, if she moves it after she initially puts it at all.
I mean, technically, by it says may not move it in any direction. So I guess up and down is a direction.
Right.
Yeah.
So I don't think, you know, I still don't like, but if the book tells me I have to call it, I'm not going to like it very much. Because I think she's not, gosh, I almost said it, that she's not gaining an advantage. Right. I didn't say that though, but I think.
But now you did.
Yes. I believe the intent of the rule is to say you're not allowed to step back. Mm-hmm. I got to read the rule. Okay, so I've got the book. The actual rule, 10-2-1-2, is exactly as I read it to you. So not allowed to move it in any direction. Tapping up and down was probably illegal by mm-hmm. rule. And so I might have missed that call. And I owe a coach an apology. I probably won't call him.
That's a good idea. Right. So another difference here is, or another thing to mention, is taking the signal. So as a pitcher, the pitcher must take the signal or appear to take a signal with the hands separated. And the ball must remain either in the glove or on a pitching hand. And simulating it, you can simulate it from the catcher. So you don't have to literally take a sign, but you do have to pause and pretend like you are.
So here's another one we're going to have to do a little bit of research on for the NCAA piece. So this document that says it's a 2025 document says, while in this position, the pitcher must take or appear to take the signal while on the pitching plate. They are not allowed to take a signal from anywhere other than the pitching plate. Mm-hmm. And I believe that that has changed in the NCAA because of the use of electronic devices now.
Yeah.
And coaches are sending in defensive plays and not necessarily pitch calls. They may be sending both of them in, but that little wrist thing is going to go boom, and she's going to look at it and she might not be standing on the plate.
Yep. So that's 10-2-2 for the NCAA.
Taking the signal. Before starting a pitch, the pitcher must comply with the following. Be in the proper pitching position required for a legal pitch. The stride foot may be on or whatever. Hands must be separated. The ball must be held in one or the other. 10-2-2. While in the pitching position and taking the signal, the pitcher must give, take, or appear to take a signal. The signal need not come from the catcher. So this says that they have to appear to take a signal while they're in the pitching thing, but it doesn't say where they have to take it from. After receiving the signal, so it really does kind of say, before starting a pitch, the pitcher must comply. They must be in the proper pitching position. Mm-hmm. We may have to look this up more in depth and insert a clarification here, because I think there's more information about this.
Okay. A small difference here is the timing for your hands to come together. In high school, the pitcher should bring their hands together for not less than 1 second, but not more than 10 seconds. But NCAA, that's different?
Yeah, the pitcher has not more than 5 seconds to deliver the pitch after the hands are brought together. Rarely do you see that. The problem that we've got in NCAA really is the timing now. You know, we have the new timing rules for in between pitches. So once the pitcher receives the ball back from the catcher, you know, in the middle of a plate appearance, the middle of an at bat, when the pitcher receives the ball back from the catcher and she's in the vicinity of the pitching area, then a 20-second clock starts for her, a 10-second clock starts for the catcher and the batter. And they're getting dinged for it, and they're being more speedy. I don't know if you saw last week, there was a college game, NCAA Division I SEC college game that ended runner at second and third, two strikes on the batter, or one strike on the batter. She was a slapper. She reached out to slap at an outside pitch, missed it, got mad at herself. Did I mention that it's the bottom of the seventh and there's two outs and they're behind by one?
Yep.
And so she's mad at herself, and so she's trying to gather herself. She's doing the whole breathing, deep breathing thing, sliding her hand up and down her bat, fixing her hat, doing her whatever. And just as she starts to step into the batter's box, dead ball, timing violation, strike on the batter, game's over.
Yo.
Ouch. Yeah. Like, ouch. Holy cow, ouch. So to any coaches that might be listening to the podcast, please, please, please speed your players up, especially in between pitches. Or if she needed that kind of time and you had a conference left, you might want to
burn it. Yeah. Especially as you get close.
Time, Blue. Yeah. Right. So I believe that was an SEC game and they probably had a visible action clock. And so the coach could see that clock just like the umpires could. Anyway, I'm not blaming anybody because I don't know the situation. I'm mm-hmm. just saying if you're in that situation and you can do that, you know, you might want to think about it.
Next, foreign substances. So a defensive player shall not at any time during the game be allowed to use any foreign substance upon the ball, pitching hand, or fingers under the supervision and control of the umpire powdered resin, not rock resin, and or an approved drying agent that is included on the list published by USA Softball may be used by the pitcher. The resin must be left on the ground and approved drying agent in the pitcher's pocket. Any pitcher who licks their fingers must wipe them off before bringing them in contact with the ball. If they violate that, that's a legal pitch. Second violation is an ejection. 622 for NFHS.
Yeah, so there's a clarification here. It says foreign substance, and for NFHS, it's the same as USA ball, and dirt is not a foreign substance, right? So dirt is part of the playing field, so it's not foreign in any way, shape, or form. So dirt doesn't apply. But in the NCAA, under the supervision and within view of the umpire, a resin drying agent may be used on the hands and fingers of the pitcher. Any substance, including resin, dirt, or saliva, applied to the pitcher's hand and fingers must be wiped off if it would transfer to the ball. That's 10-13-2. No player or other team personnel may apply moisture or any substance to the ball or into a glove, which will then contact the ball or do anything else that will deface the ball. So this is an important one. They have to wipe the dirt off. They're not allowed to put dirt on it. They're not allowed to do, like, they put dirt on their hand, they got to wipe it off. They're not allowed to put anything on the ball. So, and you may remember seeing this one. I think it was Mike was in a little battle with one of the pitchers last year, I believe it was, who didn't like the ball that he was putting into play. And she threw back like four times or five times or something like that until Mike finally said, look, this is the ball. And this is the one you're using. I couldn't see what he said on the video. But it's like, this is the ball and this is the one you're going to use. And the coach, he had to have a conversation with the coach. And so it made me go look up the ball rotation rules and that kind of thing as well. And so two things about that. One, and I got this advice from, I think it was Todd, told me that I want my pitcher comfortable. If she doesn't like a ball, I'm going to, you know, unless it gets excessive.
Which,
you know,
returning it four times seems excessive.
Yeah, it seems excessive. Yeah. So there's that. But then the actual rule for the ball rotation is that at the beginning of the inning, the pitchers get to pick the ball that they're going to use. Mm-hmm. And if that ball stays in play, that's the ball they're using, unless the umpire determines that it's unplayable.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then we'll remove it from the thing. And like, they don't get to say, hey, that ball went out of play, foul. I want to wait on that one to come back. It's like, nope, here's the next ball, you know. And so that's the one thing. So make sure you understand your ball rotation. The second thing is make sure the balls that are coming in are rubbed up. Coaches can do whatever that doesn't deface the ball in the dugout before the game, during the game, in the middle of the game, you know, before it comes back into play. You know, they can make sure that you don't have a ball that still has the gloss, you know, slick stuff from manufacturing on it beforehand. If they don't do that beforehand, you know, I've seen some college umpires actually give a game ball to the first baseman to use as warm up in the first inning and say, hey, just make sure I get this one back, you know, type thing, so that they're actually using it, throwing it on the ground, getting it dirty, that kind of thing.
So another difference here is that the batter interfering with the catcher. So in Federation ball, the batter is out when they hinder the catcher from catching or throwing the ball by stepping out of the batter's box, or when actively hindering the catcher while in the batter's box. So we had an episode about this before, about what exactly constitutes interfering with the catcher here. Anything other than standing basically stone still, the batter's box is not a safe haven. That's where it talks about actively hindering the catcher. That's just, you could be stepping back as part of a normal routine. Doesn't matter if that interfered, you're in trouble. But that's it for high school, that's an out.
And in the NCAA, regarding the effect of the batter's interference, it's a delayed dead ball. And the defensive team shall choose the result of the play, or the batter is out, and each base runner shall return to the last base legally touched at the time of the interference.
Yeah, and you should also make point that out in high school, that's a dead ball. It's an immediate dead ball. Batter's out. That's interference, which those are all the penalties that go with interference.
Yep.
And the same thing would happen, as was described there. Runners would go back to the starting because they may have left the base. The pitch, you know, is in the air at this time because it's already received to the catcher. Runner's probably running, you know, and they may, heck, depending on the speed of the runner or what the slowness of the pitch, they could have be standing on second by the time the interference
occurred. It could be close.
But it doesn't matter. We reset.
Yep. This is an interesting piece. Sidebar again. I saw another reel or something that had a umpire. It was a really close game and two runs scored on the play, and they shut it all down and sent everybody back. And here's what happened. So they had a runner at third already, and they had a runner at first, and the runner at first was stealing. And when the catcher received the ball and then she stood up to throw the ball to second to try to get the girl out, her elbow hit the umpire's mask.
Mm-hmm.
The second baseman came in and cut it off because there was a runner at third, right? So they had a first and third play going, right?
Yeah.
And so the play the ball goes away. You know, the ball got thrown away. Something happened. You know, they tried to throw it at third. Next thing you know, two runs score. And the umpire holds his hands up. You know, he's like, nope, dead ball, dead ball. I had a delayed dead ball for umpire's interference. And because the catcher was making a play on the stealing runner, it looked like, mm-hmm. right? And by rule, if that stealing runner is not made out, then it's a dead ball. Everybody goes back because, you know, there was interference from the umpire. So they weren't very happy about that. The offense was not very happy about that, but the defense was. And it was actually, I thought it was an excellent call. But boy, was it completely nobody liked it, right? They were like, oh, what's going on? What's happening? You know, and when you look at it, it knocked his mask a little sideways. And it's hard for me to tell if they actually had a play on where they were going to cut the ball off, or if because she hit him,
the
throw was short and the second baseman got it, you know? Mm-hmm. So, and that's why we just remove all of that and say, hey, if she's not out at second, then we're going to kill it and send everybody back. So while there's not a major difference in the rule for runner's lane violation, it's good to review that the only call that can be made on a runner's lane violation is the runner interfering with the first baseman's, with the player trying to receive a throw, a defensive throw at first base. If the runner interferes with that and they are not in the running lane, that's the only time you can have a running lane violation. So there's no such thing as a running lane violation if there was no throw to first base. There's mm-hmm. no such thing if the throw was so bad that she didn't even try to go get it and she wasn't in the running lane. You know, that doesn't matter. The only time the running lane matters is if the runner interferes with the first base person's ability to catch the thrown ball. That's the only time it matters. A lot of times people really get, you know, like, oh, interference or oh, obstruction. There's something bad happening. She wasn't even in the runner's lane. And it's like there was no throw to first base. It doesn't matter what running lane. So that kind of stuff. Just keep that in mind. It has to be interfering with the first base player's receiving of a thrown ball.
Yep. That all gets back to the difference between what's the base path, what's the baseline, and what's the runner's lane. You know, the runner's lane only exists one place, and that is first base, about halfway up the line-ish. And then runner makes their own base path. They can do whatever they want. And then that's where, as soon as a play is being made on a tag, that's when, you know, the whole 3 feet thing comes in. And then in this case, like you're saying, the base, the violation becomes interfering with that first baseman's. It could be the second baseman too, right? If it was a bunt.
Sure.
Is the person who's at first base receiving the
throw. That's right.
Let's not limit it to one position in the field. Just to be explicit.
The person playing first base for that play.
Yeah.
Right. So, yeah, it could be the second baseman or catcher. She's really fast. That's funny. How about obstruction, Pete?
Oh, so in next episode. So obstruction, a fielder not in possession of the ball or not making an initial play on a batted ball impedes the progress of a runner or batter runner who is legally running the bases. There we go. And then, of course, that's a delayed dead ball. And then you're doing what you do with the awarded based on what you think would have happened. And that's it. It's a very simple line.
That's
very,
right.
If it's not, because you get protection if you're making the initial play. And if you have the ball, do whatever you want. That's the idea. You got to get in front of them and tag.
Don't be malicious.
Yeah. So that's it. We're done. And then so yours, a little more complicated.
Yeah. In the NCAA, obstruction occurs when a defensive player, neither in possession of the ball nor in the act of fielding a batted ball, impedes a batter's attempt to make contact with the pitch or impedes the progress of any runner who is legally running bases on a live ball. So that sounds similar. You know, we talk in the NCAA, this rule talks about the batter's attempt, but we're talking really more about obstruction for other things. It can be intentional or unintentional. It is obstruction if a defensive player not in possession of the ball is blocking any part of the leading edge of first, second, or third base or home plate, or otherwise blocks the runner from advancing or returning to the base. The defensive player is not considered obstructing if they are in possession of the ball, like Pete said, do what you want. You got the ball, do it. Or if they're making a legitimate reaction to the trajectory of the ball after it is thrown. Additionally, if if in the umpire's judgment the runner would have been clearly out, then obstruction is ignored. Okay, we'll unpack that just a little bit for this episode. We'll dive more deeply into that in another episode, because that is kind of different for sure. Leading edge, any part of the leading edge. This is actually something that I got from Jerry Fick some time ago in high school ball, because you hear coaches say, well, they had the corner. They could get the corner. They could get the whatever. And Jerry said to me, where does it say in the rule book that the defense is allowed to control what part of the base the runner can use?
Yeah.
Right. So it's kind of been Jerry's idea because the rule doesn't rule doesn't say it. I don't know if he came up with it. So, Jerry, there you go. I'm giving you credit for it. But anyway, Jerry's idea kind of matches this, right? You're not allowed to block the leading edge. Right? Here comes a runner. And if I don't have the ball, they've got that whole leading edge that they're allowed to have access to. Jerry believed that same thing to be true. And so if you're standing there, you know, and your foot's blocking it. Yeah, I think about the girl coming back to first base, you know, and we're going to try to back pick her. And the first baseman's got her foot covering up the leading edge, and now the girl dives back and she's like, all she can get is foot or shoelaces, you know. It's like, well, that's not cool. You can't do that. Yeah. You know, so you can't do that. And then the other thing that gets a little bit hairy in the NCAA is this idea that unless the catcher is making an adjustment to her position to go after an errantly thrown ball, and that one you got to be really careful about too. It's not because she wants to catch it in the middle of her stance. Right. It has to really be like she has to, like, I got to go get that ball because I'm, you know, it's going to go to the backstop. Mm-hmm. Right. And if that calls pulls her in and she still impedes the runner, this is an important piece, it's still obstruction. Yeah. So the reason that they made that is if the catcher sets up and she's blocking the leading edge of the base, any part of the leading edge of the base or plate, it's obstruction. She set up without the ball blocking the leading edge, whether it impeded runner or not, we've got obstruction going on. She's set up wrong. You can't do that. That's obstruction. Just being in the way, if she's going after a ball, is not automatically obstruction if it doesn't impede the progress of the runner. I'm not sure how it's not gonna.
Right.
But, you know, you couldn't see my face on that one. But it's like, oh, the face. We're going to have to do some serious video watching to come up with some.
They may have left that in just because you can't imagine every crazy thing that could ever happen on a diamond.
Right.
You know, and so they just, let's be clear.
Yep. All right, Pete, last one. Let's cover the look back rule, and I think this will get all the major rule changes, differences, not changes, sorry, rule differences between NFHS and college.
All right, so for the look back rule is in effect for all runners when the ball is live, the batter runner has reached first base or has been declared out, and the pitcher has possession and control of the ball within the pitcher's circle. When a runner is legitimately off a base, the runner may stop once, but then has to immediately return to the base or advance to the next base. Once the runner stops at a base for any reason, the runner will be declared out if they leave that base. There are five different scenarios, and we won't go into those, but control of the ball can include, for us, placing the ball under her chin or between her legs. So she's standing in the circle. She's got a fiddle with her glove or her visor or her face mask. She sticks the ball between her legs. That's control of the ball there in the circle. And then obviously, look back rule goes off if you make a play on the runner. So if they're advancing, so they stopped, they made their decision to advance. And now if you throw the ball, including a pump fake, now they can return if they want because a play is being made. And now the look back rule has to be reset. You have to recircle, recontrol, and then now we look back again. So
that's right.
That's a high school.
Yep. And so in NCAA, the look back rule is in effect when the ball is live, the batter runner has touched first base, and the pitcher has possession, for example, the ball in her hand, glove, underarm, whatever, between her legs, and control of the ball within the pitcher's circle. The pitcher is considered to be in the pitcher's circle when both of her feet are within the circle or on the lines. So that's an important one there, too. The running through, so the look back rule in college allows you to run through first base, and as you are returning to first base, even if the pitcher has the ball in the circle and nobody's covering second, and you're fast enough, you can try to go get it, right? Until you come back and touch first base. Once you touch first base that second time, you're there. And if you come off the base with the balls in the pitcher circle, with the pitcher having control of it, you're going to be out on look back rule violation. In high school, you are not allowed to do that. So if you start back toward first base after you've overrun it, you have to go to first base.
Okay, so this is a little longer than usual episode. I guess, sorry for that, or you're welcome for that, I guess, depending on your opinion of us.
I think we're going to be late for lunch, Pete.
So that's it for this week, and hopefully you guys have a good season.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.